Welcome to the fourth course of Distance English. Today we have a lot of interesting topics, and we do hope that they will give something to your brain, body and soul.
But at the same time, you'll have to be all ears, because like before, there are quite a few grammar points hidden in the texts.
Various pronouns, auxiliary verbs, word formation, and so on.
Dame Edna.
Crocodile Dundee.
The Bushman, a tall, laconic, sun-tanned, weather-beaten male wearing a broad-rimmed hat.
Strident, pot-bellied, beer-swilling.
Stop that, will you? Please, both of you. That's the awful stereotype you hear about so often. Australians are not like that at all. But I have to admit, you are not the only ones with those misconceptions. Even the Australian Tourist Commission has been harnessed to promote another type of Aussie. According to the British Sunday Times, ATC's advertising will focus on the image of the new sensitive Aussie.
Dear listeners, may I introduce Peter Cooper to you? He's a native Australian and he is here with us today to tell us something about his home country. Welcome to our program, Peter.
Thank you.
Although English is spoken as an official language in Australia, we haven't dealt with it in our programs yet. Peter, the peopling of Australia took place in very much the same way as that of North America, didn't it? Only in this case, it was the Aborigines who were the original inhabitants of the continent.
Yes, Aborigines have lived in Australia at least 40,000 years, even though they now represent not much more than 1% of the nation's population.
Weren't the English the first Europeans to settle down in Australia?
Yes, it is common knowledge that after striking a coral reef in 1770, Captain James Cook beached his ship, the Endeavour, in a place on the northern coast of Australia that was later called Cooktown.
And then he sailed south to what is now Sydney, right?
Yes, and because the botanists on board with him found lots of plants unknown to them, they called it Botany Bay.
Was it the beginning of steady settlement there?
No, that was quite a few years later, in the 1780s, I think, when the penal colony of New South Wales was founded at Sydney Cove. The first settlers were in fact prisoners, convicted for petty crimes, and, of course, their guards, who were soldiers. And there were sailors too. There are several other cities and towns in Australia which were originally penal colonies. Brisbane is one, if I remember correctly.
And later on, more and more immigrants from all the four corners of the world arrived in Australia.
That's true. In the 1850s, gold was found in New South Wales, and a route had been found through the Blue Mountains from Sydney westward, which made it possible for farmers to start using the wide, fertile plains for farming. Those two facts drew large numbers of immigrants to Australia, so that in less than 10 years the population of the colonies was tripled.
Were they English?
Most of them were, yes. But Australia could easily have been settled first by the Dutch or later by the French. But even they had their predecessors, because as early as the 16th century, some Portuguese, Spanish and of course Dutch seafarers had found what was then called Terra Australis.
It is said that Australia rode to prosperity on the sheep's back. What does that saying derive from?
Well, raising and breeding sheep used to be a very important source of livelihood. A flock of sheep was imported from Spain to Australia at the end of the 19th century. The dry inland areas were suitable for sheep breeding, and merino, being the finest type of wool made, this branch of industry thrived.
Speaking of sheep, wasn't it so that in the old days, sheep owners didn't have much permanent help to shear the wool? Instead, there were wandering teams of shearers, swagmen, who did the job.
Yes, and the best known of them all around the world is probably the one singing about Waltzing Matilda, which has become almost a national anthem of Australia.
You very often hear people wondering why this guy is dancing waltz with some woman in the middle of nowhere.
Well, as a matter of fact, Matilda is not a woman at all. The name refers to a swagman's backpack, or a blanket roll, that he used to carry on his back, and which was called a swag. Interestingly enough, the origins of the name Matilda go back to German or Nordic mythology, when you know that the tune was originally a Scottish one, that in official national anthems of ours is as international as the Aussies themselves.
But your real official national anthem is Advance Australia Fair, isn't it?
You are right. By the way, do you know why the Australian coat of arms has a kangaroo and an emu on it?
No.
Because they are the only two animals that can't go backwards, and the song tells us to advance, go forward.
No kidding.
Fair dinkum.
What's that then?
That's the Australian way of saying, of course, I'm telling the truth.
I see. But there must be lots of other sayings and words that are different from standard British or American usage.
Plenty. We say, for instance, good on you, not good for you. And we also say g'day when we meet people.
I wonder if the Aboriginal language has had any effect at all on Australian English.
It certainly has. The word billabong, for example, which appeared in the song, contains the Aboriginal words billa, meaning water, and bong, meaning dead. And jumbuck used to be a dumbok, meaning white mist. A large number of Australian place names are of Aborigine origin, so that they do mean something, like Canberra, for instance, which means a meeting place.
By the way, a lot of immigration has been taking place over the years from everywhere in the world. What nationalities are represented in today's Australia?
You name it. One time, I think it was estimated that about 20% of the Australian population were born overseas. Many people are of Italian and Greek origin. Since the abolition of the White Australia policy, the purpose of which was to prevent more Chinese from immigrating, people of Asian, African and mixed descent have come to Australia. Sydney, by the way, is a metropolis with a Chinatown of its own. But today, Australia has more or less turned its face towards Asia, naturally enough. Because of its situation, Asian languages, Japanese, for example, are replacing the traditional French and German languages at school.
And of course, there are Scandinavian immigrants there too. Many Finns have relatives there, right? Even if we are a real minority.
True enough.
Well, thank you, Peter, very much for all this information about your fascinating country.
There is still a lot that we didn't have time to deal with.
Yes, and we did not say anything about the Australian landscape, which is one of the most important tourist attractions.
Nor did we present the Australia of today, its technology or people, and we didn't say a word of sports for that matter.
No. But the good thing is that this will leave something for our listeners to explore in that exciting corner of the world. The objective of the interview you just heard was not only to give you information on Australia.
We also wanted to include names or nationalities in it.
And when listening to the program again, pay attention to the following.
In some cases, the same word is used as a noun and an adjective. And the adjective is used to refer to the language in question. A good example is an Australian, which means an Australian person, while Australians refers to many of them. And they speak Australian.
And you must have noticed that in the explanation, an Australian person, the word Australian was used as an adjective.
Let's then take the group England, Ireland, Holland or the Netherlands and France.
Nouns can be formed by using the adjectives plus the respective endings man or woman, like Englishman, Englishwoman, Irishman, Dutchman, and Frenchman.
If you again wish to refer to the whole nation, you can either say Englishmen, English people, or the English.
So, what are the three ways of saying Hollandilize it or Franskalize it?
Dutchmen, Dutch people, or the Dutch.
And Frenchmen, French people, or the French. By the way, adjectives of nationalities ending in ese can also be used to form nouns referring to the whole nation. Don't forget the definite article, though. The Chinese, kinalize it. The Japanese, japanilize it.
Then we have the group of nationality words where one word is used as an adjective and another one to refer to a person.
For example, the name of our country is Finland. People living here are Finns, and the adjective and the language spoken is Finnish.
In the same way, we have Spain, Spaniards, and Spanish.
But as for Saxa, we have Germany, and one word, German, used as a noun and an adjective. Germans speak German.
This was some information on what to pay attention to when you deal with nationality words.
And once again, you no doubt noticed that there's no rule without an exception. Nowadays, we are becoming more and more health conscious. One extreme is people whose daily diets already consist of healthy meals and snacks, plus an appropriate amount of exercise, but who still find it necessary to complete their diets with products enriched with extra vitamins. The other are those who mainly consume so-called junk food, but to mitigate their consciences, or, just in case, buy vitamin-enriched products. Whatever the reason, consumption of all kinds of health foods is on the increase.
A column giving information about the effects of vitamins, supplements, or healthy diets, or answering questions on either topic, can be found in most magazines and newspapers, which raised some of the most common questions asked. You'll now hear both the questions and the answers that were suggested.
And while you're listening, we would like you to pay attention to the use of auxiliary verbs, as well as that of the pronouns one another, one the other, and some others, some the others.
In winter, I very often suffer from colds. Although a running nose, slightly too high a temperature, and a sore throat don't necessarily prevent me from going to work, I'd like to get rid of them. One way, I've been told, is to take a shot. But another, and maybe a more natural one, would be to add vitamin C in my diet. How much of it and in which form, pills, liquid, etc., would you recommend?
Some studies have shown that the use of vitamin C may decrease the severity of colds. Others, again, have shown quite opposite results. However, there are none, to my knowledge, which could prove that it could prevent colds altogether. Nutritional therapists often recommend an intake of 1,000 milligrams or more to treat colds. There's no danger of overdose, since vitamin C is water-soluble and is not stored in your body, and it's mostly consumed as a supplement. The other trouble an overdose may cause is diarrhea. The normal recommended daily intake is between 60 to 100 milligrams a day. But if your lifestyle in general, or, for the time being, for one reason or another, is somehow exceptional, you may want to increase the amount.
And then another question. I'm a 50-year-old office worker. After I had broken my wrist and got a cast at the local health center, my doctor advised me to start taking some chewing tablets to strengthen my bones or rather to prevent them from weakening. Can some tablets really have that effect? Can't you achieve the same result by taking more exercise, for example? And how long should I then go on taking them?
Your doctor may have been worried about you developing osteoporosis, a condition where your bones lose their density and get porous, which could result in a serious bone fracture, even after a minor fall on a slippery road. To prevent that, calcium can be prescribed, and one of the easiest and most convenient ways of taking it is chewing tablets. Calcium is essential for bones as well as teeth, and it's found in dairy products. Since the consumption of milk, butter, and even cheese has been decreasing, and they're very often replaced at meals by water, mineral water, or wine, and margarine and vegetables, supplements may be necessary. The RDA, recommended daily amount, is about 800 milligrams, but not more than 500 milligrams is recommended at one time. But a word of warning. Eating a lot of bran or consuming a lot of tea or alcohol can interfere with the consumption of calcium. And an interesting piece of information based on recent research results. Vegans and people suffering from lactose intolerance may find that their soya milk, strengthened with calcium, hardly contains any calcium when poured into the glass. When you shake the carton, calcium sticks to the sides, resulting in your drink having a very low calcium content.
A friend of mine keeps telling me that something called echinacea keeps you fit, lively and healthy through the winter. I suppose it's not a kind of vitamin, but rather some kind of health supplement. How and what is it supposed to affect?
Echinacea has in fact become very popular, one might say fashionable during the past few years. It's actually a herbal remedy. Lots of people have strong faith in its ability to nip colds and flu in the bud. It's said to stimulate the white blood cells to fight infectious viruses and bacteria. You should start the cure when you first feel the symptoms, like sneezing or a dizzy head. Avoid taking it for a long time, though. Rather, consult a doctor instead.
And problem number four. I've been doing weightlifting for some time. To improve, I feel I need more strength. I follow a diet which my coach has planned for me, together with the doctor of our team. However, I think I'm not developing fast enough. I was told there are some nutrients that could help. What would you suggest?
Energy is what a sportsman needs most, and it's supplied in the body in the form of calories, mainly from carbohydrates and fat. This is what you regulate by a diet. But whenever you engage in hard physical exercise at extreme levels, when you have to be stronger, more powerful, or recover more quickly from training, you need something to stimulate the muscles so that they will contract, get shorter. There are quite a few supplements, both in powder and tablet form, which are taken in water or fruit juice. Then, of course, there are preparations which can be used in between meals and as a meal replacement. However, it is strongly recommended that whatever supplements you may decide to use, you first discuss it with your coach and your doctor. A sportsman can never be too careful with supplements. They may affect different people in very different ways. Not all doctors agree about them. Some say they're effective. Others are strongly against them. You'll have to decide yourself what's good for you. But at the same time, you mustn't forget the importance of normal physical training. What your club needs most is healthy sportsmen. What it doesn't need is wrecks spoilt by excessive use of drugs.
Coventry is an industrial city near Birmingham in central England. Years ago, I was in England on a course which included an excursion to the Cathedral Church of St. Michael in Coventry. We had an excellent guide who told us the history of both the old and the new cathedral as well as the symbolism behind the reconstruction of the cathedral. I was so fascinated by all the details we were told that I returned there some 10 years later and interviewed the guide who was then in charge. Unfortunately, I don't have his name anymore, but I would like to express my gratitude to him in this way. What you are now going to hear is roughly what I then taped, the story of a cathedral which was reborn from the flames of war. And if you get interested in the works of art mentioned by the guide, visit the cathedral internet pages www.exponet.co.uk/peter/covcath.htm.
On the night of the 14th of November, 1940, the cathedral was hit by German bombs. Coventry was the first British city that was destroyed in this way, and the only one that lost its medieval cathedral. In the morning, when it was possible to examine the damage, two partly burned roof beams were found. These charred beams were fixed together in the form of a cross to symbolise destruction. The decision to rebuild the cathedral was made on the very same day on which it was hit. The new cathedral was designed by Sir Basil Spence, who won a competition for it. Very little could be done about the old part. Sir Basil's idea was to have a new building constructed next to the ruins, and thus unite the past and the future, to express sacrifice and resurrection, faith and reconciliation. Any visitor who comes to the cathedral must commence his visit in the ruins of the old building. It's important to remember that the new part of the cathedral is rather like a side chapel to the original cathedral, of which only the ruins are left, and the first part of which was built between 1373 and 1396. When you leave the old cathedral, down what is called Queen's Way, you then come to the Great Porch. This links the old ruins with the new cathedral, which is made of concrete, glass and steel. These materials are very appropriate in a modern city like Coventry, of which the cathedral is the centre. This porch is, in fact, an important part of the building, because it means that the cathedral is never closed. People can walk back and forth through the heart of the building any time of the day or night, because the porch is an ancient right-of-way connecting the city centre to the cathedral. After you enter the cathedral, it looks as if it were a windowless building. In fact, there are five pairs of windows hidden away in the recesses. They're sometimes referred to as Swedish windows, because they were the work of a Swedish artist, Einar Forseth. Each of these windows has a complete theme in it, from floor to ceiling. The floor of the building is all marble. The black marble came from Kilkenny in Ireland, where marble has been taken for the past 2 million years. The grey marble is original English marble. The high altar itself is the largest in the world. It's 21 feet long, and it's a copy of Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper altar table. Hanging immediately behind that is a huge tapestry, which is also the largest in the world, roughly the size of a tennis court. The tapestry is the work of Graham Sutherland, who got the inspiration for it from the Book of Revelation. It's made of fine Australian merino wool and has altogether some 12,000 miles of wool. It weighs 1,600 weight. The symbols around it, in four little boxes, are those of the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The tapestry was made in northern France, and it took 10 people working for 3 years to complete it. When you move to the right, you'll come to what's called the Chapel of Industry. The windows of this chapel are all clear glass. And when the cathedral was built, in 1962, it was then possible to see out to the factories of Coventry. Since then, the Coventry Lancaster Polytechnical College has expanded, and the views of the industry are badly blocked by the college. The chapel has a central altar, which was made by the boys in Coventry Technical College. Over the altar is a great cross with nails, which was made by the men of Coventry Aircraft Factory. The chapel is used frequently for services and for exhibitions, and a number of chaplains go out to factories, and in return, industrial companies come for services in this chapel. Finally, there is the Chapel of Unity, which was the gift of the King and Queen and the people of Sweden. This is a chapel which is used by Christians of all denominations.